Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back to Book Therapy. This is Rob Cohen, and it has been a while since we talked. Lots been going on. There was obviously a lot of reading. There was a trip to Vegas. There's been some, just a lot of hectic stuff going on. And as typically happens around this time of the year, as baseball season starts back up, my reading progress starts to slow down a little bit. When there's no baseball season, I can put the girls to bed about 8 or 8:30, and then I have a good two and a half hours of reading each night that I can do, and I can usually burn through a couple books a week. But once baseball season starts, I gotta tell you, I'm dedicated to the Dodgers. I'm watching the games every night. Typically, they're not ending until 10 or 10:15, and then I really only have about 45 minutes to an hour of reading I can do each night. So it takes me a little longer to get through some of these books. But nevertheless, I am back. This is Book Therapy. As usual, you can find me on Twitter at RobCohen13. You can find the podcast at booktherapy.podbean.com. I have the blog website at RobCohen13.com and on Goodreads at RobCohen13. Whatever, you know how to find me. Let's get to it. I think when we last spoke, the book I was in the middle of reading was The Red Breast by Joe Nesbø. And as we talked about, Joe Nesbø is a Norwegian author who seems to have gotten a little bit of attention by virtue of all of the extra attention that's been placed because of the Stieg Larsson books. And I guess after the Millennium Trilogy came out, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, etc., there was a lot of interest in some of the Scandinavian authors, and so Joe Nesbø seemed to fall right into that category. The book I read, The Red Breast, is actually the third book in a series involving a police inspector by the name of Harry Hooley. As I mentioned earlier, I'm not sure why the third book in the series was the first book that got translated into English. There are two previous books that still have not been translated into English, whereas as of now, I seem to think that there's something like 7 or 8 of the Harry Hooley books that have been translated, and in fact, I think Joe Nesbø came out with a new book not too long ago. But nevertheless, having been a big fan of the Stieg Larsson books and looking for a little something different, I picked up the Joe Nesbø book, The Red Breast, and I really enjoyed it. I like the character a lot of Harry Hooley. He reminds me a little bit of Inspector Rebus from the Ian Rankin books. I read the first Ian Rankin book called Knots and Crosses, and I wasn't really terribly thrilled by it. I haven't had much of interest to go back and continue forward from that very first book, but different from that, the Harry Hooley book, I really, really enjoyed. And the book did something which I struggled with back at a time when I had given some thought to writing, because everybody wants to write a book. Everybody has the idea that they're going to, you know, create the great American novel. And as of course I did, one of the ideas I had for a story, really, I struggled with it. I couldn't figure out how to keep it suspenseful. I couldn't figure out how to keep it a mystery. And basically what it was a story idea that came out of a case that I worked on about 7 or 8 years ago. And it involved an elderly Chinese woman who had a very difficult time communicating, had some severe physical and mental difficulties. And we got retained by a private investigator who was hired by a Chinese national to locate this Chinese woman here in Los Angeles someplace. So after he located her, this private investigator struck up a friendship with the old woman and decided that she needed some care, she needed some attention, and so he wanted to petition with the Chinese national's approval, of course. He wanted to petition to be appointed her conservator, like her guardian, to make her decisions for her. And we had meetings with a private investigator, and we had meetings with the Chinese national, and English was very poorly spoken by the investigator, and the Chinese national did not speak any English at all. Although there was one instance where he did come over from China and brought a very nice bottle of scotch for me, thinking that I'd done something great for him. But nevertheless, the idea of this woman's identity and her having some historical impact was something that I kind of thought might be an interesting story idea. Something like a cross-generational story where you've got two parallel storylines of current day involving the attempts by various people to get control over her person and her estate. And then balance that with a parallel storyline involving her sometime in World War II. Now, I wasn't going to keep it as specific and identical as the circumstances of the case I was handling, but I had given ideas to making her involved in some of the Nazi Germany goings on, and I just couldn't figure out a way to plot out the dual storylines while making it still a mystery that the woman in the flashback story was the same woman who was being fought over by various people to try and get control. And then there was, of course, what the secret was, why she was so important. So I struggled with that, a way to keep the mystery aspect of it, because I like the mystery. There's a thriller, and the thriller certainly has the storyline, which seems to be fairly linear, even to the point where the whodunit is not much of a whodunit. It's more of a why done it, or how do you stop it from happening again type of thing. The culprit, the bad guy, is not much of a secret. There's no big reveal. But I like the idea of creating a big reveal. And I couldn't figure out how to do that with the storyline that I started to brainstorm. In The Redbreast, Nesbo does a fantastic job of actually doing that, because he does track two separate parallel storylines. One of them takes place in the current day, and one of them takes place in 1944 during World War II with a couple of Norwegian nationals who actually defect to fight with the Germans. And I think it's pretty clear from the story that the Norwegians were an allied country. But this handful of Norwegians go and fight for Germany. And while we're reading the 1944 storyline, the character names are set out for us, whereas in the current day storyline, the only information we have is that the gentleman is named the Old Man. So he's not specifically identified. So we know that the Old Man is one of the characters that took place, one of the characters in the 1944 storyline. But even though those characters had names and various of them died at certain points because of the war, you still don't know for sure which of those characters ends up being the Old Man in the current day story. So not only was there the built-up suspense of what the Old Man's motive was and what his ultimate game plan was, why he was doing what he was doing, why he was killing the people he was killing, and what the ultimate showdown was going to be, you also had the other aspect of, well, who is this guy really? We just know him as the Old Man. We don't know which character from the 1944 storyline he really is. And so when it's finally revealed, it definitely has a stronger impact of, okay, I get it. You know, there's a reveal, not just a tracking of a story where we know all the characters involved. So I thought that was really a very creative way to address that type of a story, because when you get into tracking parallel stories like that take place over different generations, it's difficult to, not lead the reader down a path of obviousness as to who the current day character is as it relates to the prior generation character story. So from that standpoint, obviously I thought that it was very entertaining. The book seemed to fly by. The pages just kept turning and turning and turning. I did read it on the Kindle. I mentioned before, I have a little bit of a concern that when I read something on the Kindle, I'm not getting the full story. It just seems like it's a very easy way to cut passages, to cut chapters. There's no real good way of ensuring that everything that's in the Kindle version is what's in the hardcover paperback version. But nevertheless, a very, very enjoyable book. And as soon as I finished that, I really had the idea of purchasing the next book in line and starting right up to it and just moving right on to the next story. Because as I read some of the synopsises of the following books, it seems like they seem to get better and better. They really seem to develop an intensity. The storyline of the character himself of Harry Hooley does seem to track from one to the next, which is something that a lot of book series involving the same character don't really do a lot of. Like I've mentioned before, my favorite character is Harry Bosch from the Michael Connelly stories. And for all intents and purposes, each book is pretty much a standalone. Very rarely does one book trail directly into the next book. Similar with the Robert Crace, the Elvis Cole, and Joe Pike stories, they don't typically delve from one to the next or dovetail from the one to the next. So you can read them out of order. it seems like the Nesbo books, at least between The Red Breast and the next book, which I think is called Nemesis, and then the book after that called The Devil Star, I think, those books seem to track one to the next where you really have to read them in order, otherwise you'll be lost or a little bit behind or maybe a little unsure of what's going on. So I'm really looking forward to the second book in the series, the second book that's been translated, the fourth book in the series, Nemesis, which I will pick up pretty soon, I think. But man, it's just, all of a sudden, there seems like there's a whole lot of great books to read. When I finished the book before The Redbreast, whatever that was, I went to my bookshelf and I looked around, and I've got stacks of books on the bookshelf. I couldn't find a book to read. I couldn't find one that I was really excited about, even though all of them at one point or another I did want to read and probably still do want to read. I couldn't find one that was grabbing me, that was really screaming to me, hey, you need to read this book now. And yet now, less than 2 weeks later, I look on my bookshelf and I look on my Kindle and I've just got stacks of books. Each one of them looks just as exciting as the next. One of the books I got came out just a couple weeks ago, the new David Baldacci book called The Hit. David Baldacci to me is an interesting author. I've read virtually all of his books and I've read them in order. And starting with the very first book, Absolute Power, then Total Control and The Winner and Moving Forward. His books never scream out to me, you need to drop everything and read me now. It's very strange. I always get the book when it comes out, very close to the release date, if not on the release date. And then I put it on my shelf and I look at it. And I decide I'll read another book first, and then I'll get to another one. And even though I do want to read the Baldacci book, it's not screaming out to me, you need to stop everything and read this book. And yet, the vast majority of the Baldacci books that I've read, when I do read them, I mean, I'm incredibly impressed by them. And I think, well, why did I wait so long to read this? This one's really damn good. And with this latest one, The Hit, I know that's going to be the case because it involves a character from a previous book that I really did enjoy. I don't know which book it is. He's got so many different characters who have multiple books that it gets to be a little confusing as to which book involved which character. Just so you know, one of his characters, or one of the series of books involving some of the characters of Stone and Maxwell, their former Secret Service agents who become private detectives, that series of books has actually been developed into a television show for TNT, which starts, I think the first episode is a month from today, June 10th, and involves John Tenney and Rebecca Romijn. So, man, I'm looking forward to that. I've got to set my TiVo as soon as it comes up, because that was actually a really good set of books involving those characters. The storylines themselves may not have been the strongest, but the interplay between the characters, certainly the romantic tension between them, because they're not together, but they are kind of, really has a draw to it. But the flip side, there are some dogs. Baldacci has written some dogs, and two of the books that he's written within the last year and a half involve a character named John Puller. And I think that the John Puller books, he's written two of them, the last one came out only within the last 4 or 5 months. The John Puller books to me are a response to the adoration and attention that's been given to the Jack Reacher books by Lee Child, because John Puller is, for lack of any other better comparison, he is Jack Reacher. He's a special investigation with the Marines. He's, you know, the same size, 6'6 or 6'10 or whatever it is, you know, a master at hand-to-hand combat. All of the same traits that Jack Reacher has, it seems that John Puller has, and so it's easy to get confused between the two when you're reading the books. But neither of the two John Puller books have really been outstanding to me. They seem to drag. The character is pretty one-dimensional. And just not as engaging as the Jack Reacher character is. So that's another one where I'll probably buy it when the next John Puller book comes out, but I just may not be racing to read it. But, as I mentioned, the one that came out a couple weeks ago, The Hit, which involves a previous character by the name of John Roby, I think, John Roby, who's a hitman. This one looks like it's pretty good, and it's gotten some really good reviews. Some of the reviews I've read say it's one of the best that Baldacci's come out with in quite a while, which I think is good, because I think Baldacci needs to have something that's really strong, a really tight story. So looking forward to it, but I got so many other good books on my shelf. And before The Hit came out, after I finished The Red Breast, I was looking for something else to read, and I decided that I was going to pick up The Gods of Gothman. And we've talked about it before. I've been looking for a specific type of a book. I've been looking for that gritty, cobblestone street, Victorian England, murder mystery, Jack the Ripper type thing. And even though I know The Gods of Gotham takes place in New York in 1845, in New York City in 1845, the reviews of the book still gave it, at least gave me the idea that it maybe had some of those traits. And when you've got, you know, writers like Michael Connelly, who's reviewing it and it's on the book jacket as to how great it is, and another writer who compares it to The Alienist, which we've discussed before as kind of being the penultimate book, at least in my reading history, of this type of genre. And then you've got Caleb Carr himself, who wrote The Alienist, talking about how great this book is. Laurie King, who writes a series of books involving Mary and Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock Holmes is an aged man, and his protege, a female by the name of, I think, Mary Russell, which I read one of those books. Matthew Pearl, who wrote The Da Vinci Club and The Poe Shadow, which is another author who I really enjoyed. It the last Dickens. It's a melding of history and historical characters with mysteries. And then another review on this book was by Stephanie Pintoff, who wrote In the Shadow of Gotham, another book that I read, which takes place around the same time, similar to The Truth of All Things that we talked about last time. All of the signs were pointing to this book to be spectacular. And in fact, I saw this morning that this book, The Gods of Gotham, was nominated for an Edgar Award for Best First Novel. If you're not familiar with the Edgar Awards, it's the awards, Edgar Awards are given out by the Mystery Writers of America, which is an association of mystery writers. And, you know, it's a pretty strong award to get. I mean, it's really prestigious. So if you're getting, you know, the Edgar Award, I think that means something. And The Gods of Gotham was nominated for either Best Novel or Best First Novel. I'm not sure. So with all of that said, I really wanted to enjoy this book. I really was looking forward to it. And it just didn't do it for me. And as I'm reading the book, there's a couple of things that are standing out to me that are just not, they're not grabbing me about the book. Now, one of the things that I found is with this book, as well as The Truth of All Things, the books, neither of those were particularly dark enough. We never see the crimes taking place. So let me set the Gods of Gotham for you. It takes place in 1845, and the main character's name, and it's a first-person narration. The main character's name is Timothy Wilde. Timothy Wilde. And he's a bartender. And he's been saving up money. He's been saving up his silver. And when he gets enough, he's going to ask his girlfriend, not his girlfriend, a girl that he grew up with. Her name is Mercy. He's going to ask her to marry him because she's, you know, the girl of his dreams, and he's in love with her. But a devastating fire in New York City takes place, and Timothy's his home is destroyed, and all of his savings are destroyed, and as well as the bar that he was working in. To get him back on his feet, at that time, the first police force was being set up, and Timothy's brother, Valentine, signed Timothy up to be a police officer. Now, Timothy doesn't know anything about being a police officer, but during one of his very first patrols, a young girl comes up to him. She is, covered in blood and screaming and hysterical, and turns out that there are numerous, ten or 20 bodies buried, and they're bodies of young children. So just from that, it seems like you've got a little bit of that darkness that's kind of coming. You're going to see the darker side of people. You're going to see really the dark side of society that certainly believes it's okay to kill kids, and the kids were working as prostitutes, and it seems like it was going to have all of the right ingredients. But as I'm reading the book, I'm noticing that there's an ingredient that's missing, and the character that's missing from the story is the bad guy. we never see the bad guy. His true identity, we learn who that is, and it turns out it was somebody that we had that our main character had been interacting with throughout the book. But that's not what I mean. The bad guy in the process of committing his crimes is not a character in the book. We don't get to see him commit the crime. The crime is already committed by the time the book starts. And in fact, there's another one or two other crimes that take place. And again, it's not fly on the wall as the crimes are taking place. It's the main character who comes to the scene and finds that the crime has already occurred. And I know that that's a limitation because of the fact that the book is in first person. You're limited by what the first person narrator is able to tell you. So he cannot describe events that are happening to which he's not present for. But I think that from that standpoint, the book loses something because the bad guy is not a character in the story. And that's really, to me, where the suspense comes from, where the darkness comes from, where the grit comes from. It's watching the bad guy at work. I mean, it's one thing to have your hero, but your hero is nothing without a bad guy. And instead of being this race to discover the identity of the bad guy because he's going to kill again, and we've seen him kill along the way, it really is just a slow-moving chase of discovery. And this book did not seem to have a deadline. It didn't seem to have a, if we don't stop him by X date, he's going to do it again. There didn't seem to be a gun to the head of our character to really solve these murders. Otherwise, more people would be killed. So there wasn't an intensity, even from the standpoint of our main character, to solve the crimes. At least in The Truth of All Things, with the Salem witch trials, we knew that as the characters were narrowing down the motives behind the murders, we knew that there was a deadline. There was a date coming up where another murder was going to take place. And so there was an intensity to the sleuthing that the characters needed to get it done or else more people would be killed. That wasn't in The Gods of Gotham. Because we never saw the murder. We never saw what the motive was. The motive is only revealed to us towards the end of the book when the actual murderer is identified and he kind of dispels the reasons for the murder. So there's no intensity. There's nothing there that says, oh, I got to flip the page because they better make another stride towards finding out who the murderer is. Otherwise, we get another step closer to more people dying. And that just slows the book down to me. It doesn't require my attention. One of the things that makes me turn the pages faster and faster and faster is the belief that I need to speed up the character's pace of finding the culprit in order to stop the future event from happening. I mean, it sounds kind of ridiculous, but if I close the book and I put it down, that means that my characters in the book, or the characters I'm reading about in the book, they're not progressing further to solving the crime. And if they're not making progress in solving the crime, that means that the murderer is one step closer to getting away with it, or one step closer to succeeding in the next crime, whatever that crime is supposed to be. He's getting closer to the date on which that next crime is going to take place. But especially what I recognize in The Gods of Gotham, it was no problem. I'll put the book down. I'll put it away. I'll decide I'm not going to read another chapter. You know, it's 11 o'clock. I could read another chapter, or I'll just go to bed. You know, I'll go to bed. Because there didn't seem to be an intensity on the part of the characters to figure out who done it. I mean, if the characters aren't pushing and racing around to get to the end, then the pages aren't flying. And this one was pretty methodical. It was pretty straightforward. It was just a detective story, and it was straightforward. I'm not saying that it wasn't complex. There were definitely a lot of complexities, a lot of characters, a lot of different characters who had shady motives. But there wasn't a, like I mentioned, a future date where another murder was going to take place, that if they didn't solve the crime by that point, then more people were going to die. And that is crafted in two ways. One is if the murderer is an active participant, because each chapter, each occurrence where the murderer, the culprit is committing a crime, that's where the tension comes from. That's where the excitement comes from, because the villain is imperative to the story. He needs to be lurking in the shadows. And when you think about it, all great stories, all great movies, they are sparked by a great villain, whether it's Darth Vader or Jaws or J.R. Ewing or Don Corleone. It's the villains on screen that really drive the story. And even with Jaws, where you don't really see Jaws so much, he's the looming presence. When you see the ocean and you see the people swimming in the ocean, you may not see the fin of Jaws coming out of the water. You may not even hear the music start up yet, but you know he's out there. And you know that at any moment, it could be now, it could be 5 minutes from now, or it could be 20 minutes from now, after this scene, another scene, and come back to the beach. You know that Jaws is there. And with the Gods of Gotham, you didn't know that he was there. The Truth of All Things actually started out really well that way, because the first chapter of the book is actually the first victim as she's interacting with the murderer, and the murderer actually speaks. So I was excited from that standpoint that, hey, this is a villain who's actually going to be an active participant in the story. It kind of fell off after that, and it didn't take place. Gods of Gotham, it never happened. He's not there. If there's no villain, then there's nothing to keep the pace of the book up. You know, if you have more instances of the villainy, you have more killings, you have more gore, you have more violence. And in the first 250 pages of The Gods of Gotham, and it's only a 430-page book, there was none of that. So the book drags, and there's no sense of urgency. There's no impending doom. There's nothing like that. Now, by comparison, the book that I read last year, which I deemed to be the number one book that I'd read all year, was a book called The Incendiary's Trail by James McCreet. And what made that book so spectacular was the fact that the villain was there. He was there in the first chapter as the murders are being committed. He's there in the fourth chapter when he goes to visit the prostitute and kills her. He's there in the sixth chapter. He's there in the tenth chapter. Now, I'm not saying that the villain and the hero need to alternate chapters. I'm not saying that at all. But I'm telling you, you have to agree. You've read these books where the villain's on stage. He's on your radar. You're reading about him. You're gripped by him. And then you go to the hero. And while you're reading the story about the hero, you're flipping pages ahead. You're looking to see, when does the bad guy come back on screen? When is he going to be back on the pages of this book? And it may not be every other chapter. It may be every third, fourth, or every fifth chapter. But I'm telling you, it's 11:15 at night. You're getting ready to go to bed. You look. You've just finished a chapter involving the bad guy. You're going to keep reading because you want to see that bad guy come on screen again. And Gods of Gotham didn't have it. It didn't have it. And even in the last couple books I've read, The Redbreast, The Da Vinci Code, the bad guy was there. Let's not forget, in The Da Vinci Code, you had Silas. And he was the guy who killed the guy at the Louvre. He killed the nun. He was there. He was the looming presence. He was the shadow in the corner that you knew as soon as you turned your eye away and focused all your attention on your hero, he was going to spring back into the pages, and he was going to do something, you know, truly frightful. Or frightening, or terror-filled. He was going to be there. And Gods of Gotham didn't do that. It didn't. It was straightforward. And now look, the author did a fantastic job of research, obviously recreating 1845 in New York, the explanation of the creation of the police officers, and the fire, and the different wards, as how the city was broken up. Spectacular historical analysis or historical insight into that time period. But there was nothing particularly compulsive about the book itself. And when you don't have that level of compulsiveness, the book, where the book doesn't grab you, where the book is not demanding that you read the next page. And there have been books that I've read that don't have the same involvement of the murderer. That's true. Look, I'm going to tell you, none of the Harry Bosch books have the murderer as a character. None of them do. So I don't want you to think I'm being hypocritical by saying that Gods of Gotham was not a good book in my mind, because the murderer wasn't there, and then I'm going to tell you that, oh, but the Michael Connelly books are so great, when theoretically they're similar in the respect that the murderer doesn't show up. But you need to have, if you're not going to have the murderer or the villain or the bad guy, if you're not going to have that character as a active party in the book, then you have to make your main character really, really interesting. And Timothy Wilde in The Gods of Gotham wasn't. He wasn't even the most interesting person. He wasn't the most interesting person in the book, that's for sure. He wasn't the most interesting character who was a police officer. There was a character in the book. His name was Mr. Piest, I think. P-I-E-S-T. And he was another police officer. And he kind of helped Timothy at various points. But you're not sure who he is or what he did. The picture I kept in my mind while I was reading the book and this character, Mr. Piest, would show up was the character of Argus Filch from the Harry Potter movies. And if you remember, Argus Filch was the hallway monitor, basically. He was the one who made sure that the kids were in bed. And he had, like, scraggly hair that was greasy, and he had a hooked nose, and he kind of always had a sneer, and he looked like he'd been crawling through the sewers. And I had a picture that this was this Mr. Piest, because he somehow, every once in a while, would crop up, and give the main character, a little piece of information that he had somehow figured out. And that would move Timothy a little bit further on into the investigation. And I started to read with the expectation or hope that this Mr. Piest would be more involved in the story. And it is a truly bad sign when the reader doesn't even care about the main character and wants the main character to become a secondary character so that other characters can be focused on. And that was just, you know, the fault that I had with the book. There just seem to be lots of those types of little idiosyncrasies about the book that when you add them all up, it makes for a book that is not compulsive to read, is very slow, easy to put down. At various times, I wondered whether I even wanted to finish. So I just kind of wonder what I missed. Now, there's an interesting aspect about the book, The Gods of Gotham, that I kind of wanted to discuss, because it's something that I heard on a different podcast, and it struck a chord with me. One of the podcasts that I listened to talked about an award that was being given out to women authors. And the two gentlemen who host the podcast were discussing whether at this day and age it was even necessary to have a separate award that was focused solely on women authors. And as they were discussing this, they came to the conclusion that the two of them are pretty even when they looked at their books as far as the books that they'd read as whether they were written by men or women. In fact, one of the guys said that if he were to look back at the books he's read this year, 50% of them were written by men and 50% were written by women. And the other host of that podcast mentioned a similar type of a ratio. So after hearing that, I went back to my list of the books that I'd read this year, starting with January 1st, and I counted how many of the books I'd read were written by women. And would you believe that other than The Gods of Gotham, which is written by a woman, Lindsay Fay, I had read exactly zero books that were written by women. Every single book that I'd read this year prior to The Gods of Gotham had been written by a man. And that was really kind of staggering to me. Although when I thought about it, it really wasn't that staggering, because there's a little bit of an explanation to it. Look, I'm not sexist. I have no problem with women authors, and that probably came out sounding poorly. But I typically don't read women authors. And there's a couple of reasons for it. One is because of the types of books that I like to read, I frequently don't find women authors who write in that type of a genre. I want to read mysteries, I want to read gore, I want to read suspense, thrillers, I want to read grit, darkness, and I don't know of women authors that write in that type of a genre. Now, you may say, well, hold on, Rob, there are authors out there who do write in that type of genre, and I'll agree with you, I'm sure there are, whether they're people like Tess Gerritsen or Lisa Scott-Aline or Mary Higgins Clark, I know that they're out there, but here's where I will take it to the next step. I don't particularly enjoy reading female lead characters, and it's not sexist. Maybe it is. I don't identify with women characters. I just don't. And they can be as gritty and hard-nosed as a male character, but I still wouldn't see a whole lot of excitement in picking up that book. I just don't. Whether it's I don't identify with the character, or it's difficult for me to separate the character from its femininity. And in some books, femininity is important. You got a book like, or a character out of the Janet Ivanovich books, whatever her name is, Stephanie Plum, the bounty hunter. But her femininity, I think, has some strong application. But I don't want to read a book about women, police officers or detectives or private investigators who also have to, talk about romantic interests with guys and get girly about that stuff. And they may not. The books don't do that. Some of them do, some of them don't. But I've read books in the past that have had female lead characters, and I just don't have any gravitation towards it. I've read book by Perry O'Shaughnessy, which had a woman main character who's a criminal defense attorney or a police officer. I don't even remember what it is. So I've read a handful of books by women with women main characters, and I really haven't. I haven't found a book that's really grabbed me that says, you know what, you got to read this book. Who cares if it's by a woman? Who cares if it's about a woman? And Gods of Gotham, I didn't really pay attention to the fact it was by a woman. And look, in all fairness, there was nothing about the book that screamed out femininity to me anyways. I'm not going to say that the Gods of Gotham was a bad book because it was written by a woman. Not at all. It had nothing to do with that. A male character, the main character, Timothy Weil, wasn't particularly exciting, but I don't blame that on the fact that the author was a woman. That has nothing to do with it. So if there is a book out there that has that grit and that gore and that darkness to it, and it's by a woman, yeah, I'll read it. But it's got to grab me. If it's going to be a run-of-the-mill police procedural or a standard whodunit involving a female lead character, it's really got to grab me. And I read the Patricia Cornwell books, or I read one of them, and I didn't particularly like it. And offhand, I can't really think of a whole lot of other books there. I think I read like a Nancy Taylor Rosenberg book a while ago about a female judge or female attorney or whatever it was. And I'll read books that have female main characters. And if they're written by men, yeah, I'll read those. Richard North Patterson had a couple of books that involved a female lead character who was an attorney and then she was a judge. I think it was the Final Judgment or the... Yeah, The Final Judgment, I think, is what one of them was called. I think the main character's name was Caroline Masters. And they were fantastic. I really enjoyed them. And that had nothing to do with her being a female character. I enjoyed the writing. I enjoyed Richard North Patterson. He's one of my favorite authors. And so I picked up the book. But to start a series of books or to pick up a book out of the blue that's by a woman that involves a women lead character, it's really got to be something that's going to grab me. Because... otherwise, I'll just stick with the male authors. I hate to say it. I don't want to sound sexist. It has nothing to do with that. Believe me, if you out there, any of you listening to this, if you've got a book by a female author that you're telling me will stand up to a Robert Kraes or a Michael Connelly or a Joe Nesbo at this point, yeah, I'll read it. I absolutely will read it. But you got to get it to me. You got to tell me what that is. You got to find it for me because I'm not going to find it. When I'm looking through the book stands, I'm looking at the murders and thrillers, or mysteries and thrillers, and I'm seeing a female author. I'm seeing an Agatha Christie. I'm going, nope, read it, not interested. Whether it's Hercule Poirot or Miss Marples, nope, not interested. I'm just not. If it's a Janet Ivanovich, nope, not interested. There's this new character that came out, I think Jacqueline Winspear, I think is the name of the author, and involves a character named Maisie Dobbs, and it takes place, I think, the 1910s in London, and the main character is I don't know if she's a housemaiden or a housekeeper or something like that, who also solves mysteries on the side or something like that. And I picked up the books a couple times, and I've seen the reviews, they're all great, and I'm going, no, I don't know. Maybe I'll have to. I'm not against it, but I told you earlier, I got so many books on my bookshelf to read. It's got to be something that's going to be pretty damn spectacular, and I don't want to be disappointed. I don't, because I'll put the book down. I'll read half of it, and I'll say, this isn't going to do it for me, and I'll put it down. And, yeah, find me a book. I beg you, find me a book. I'd love to read it. After I finished The Gods of Gotham, a friend of mine, who I know through networking, had recommended a book to me. Somebody that he'd gone to high school with and had actually run cross-country with had written a book, and my friend Colin had asked me if I'd heard of the author, and I'd said that I hadn't. And I told him to email me the author, and I'd take a look at it. And before I knew it, Colin had actually purchased a book for me for my Kindle. And so I had to read it. And it was actually a very, very good book. And to Colin, I've already thanked him. But thank you again for buying the book for me, because I really enjoyed it. It was a different kind of a book. It was a book called Domestic Violets, and that's violets as in the flowers, V-I-O-L-E-T-S, by Matthew Norman. And as far as I can tell, Matthew Norman has not written any other books. This was his first novel. And after I finished the book and I emailed Colin to thank him for buying it for me and tell me that I enjoyed the book, he wrote me back and mentioned that he believed that this was a book for our generation. And when I say our generation, I'm talking mid-30s. And the reason why is because the main character is somebody to whom I would very closely identify with. He is in his mid-30s. He's 35 or 36. He's got a 7 or 8-year-old daughter. He's married. He's stuck in a job that he doesn't like. And he's going through what I would call a bit of a midlife crisis in his mid-30s. And I always was the belief that the midlife crisis was something that happened in the 40s and 50s, age-wise. That was something that after you'd had kids, after the kids had grown up, maybe they'd gone to college or moved out, that was the time when you started to question what was left for you. Your life was, you know, closer to being over than from birth. You know, you were closer to death than birth. You had less years ahead of you than you had behind you. And you started to panic about how much time you had left and all the things you hadn't done yet, and looking back on your life and wondering what the purpose of your life was and things like that. And we would see on television or movies the mid-50s guy who goes and dyes his hair so he doesn't have gray anymore, and he goes and buys a fast sports car, and he has an affair, and he divorces his wife and marries, you know, a 20-something. And that was when I always thought the midlife crisis took place. But from Domestic Violets, and it was something that I went through. You find out that maybe the midlife crisis for our generation is going to start happening earlier and earlier. And I'm not sure why. I've given it a little bit of thought. I don't know. Maybe it has to do with the intensity of the educational system at this point and how we're heaping so much pressure on the kids to really produce. You know, my parents' generation, they were successful getting out of college with a degree and getting a job, and they were able to support a family and do very well for themselves. My generation, you're getting out of college with a degree, you can't find a job. You've got to go do something else. You've got to go get a higher degree. You've got to go get a master's, a PhD. You've got to go to law school. You've got to, do some higher education. You've got to, whether it's a higher education in the form of a PhD or master's, or you're getting a CFP, a CLU, or whatever it is, you know, some more letters that you can put behind your name. There's this pressure to raise your educational level in order to keep up with everybody else that's out there. And when I was going through high school, a 4.0 was as good as you can get. And now you're hearing about students who are getting 4.2s and 4.4s and 4.6s. And you're thinking, when do these kids have time to be kids? Well, they don't. They don't have time to be kids. And I look back on my life and I think, well, maybe, you know, I didn't have as much time to be a kid. From the time I got to college, it was straight through college, no break, straight into law school, no break, straight into practice. So by the time I turned 30, I'd been married a few years. When I turned 30 is when I had my first kid. By the time I turned 35, it was like, okay, now what? Now what do I do? Where does my life go from here? I've accomplished all my goals. I've done everything I set out to do. I got my law degree. I'm a practicing attorney. I'm a partner in a firm. I'm married. I have a kid. I'm 35 years old, and I've accomplished all the goals that I set out for myself when I was 10. What else is there? And in Domestic Violets, the main character, Tom Violet, he's going through that. He's going through that very same thing. He's got a job that he's doing what he likes. I mean, he's a copywriter. It's not the best thing, but he envisions himself as a writer, so he gets to write at least. But he works for a company that he doesn't really know what they do, and they don't, as in his mind, they don't provide any type of benefit to society. He's got a like an intern or an associate of his who's who works under him, another copywriter, but he's her mentor, so to speak. And she's a young, you know, mid-20s type of a thing, and she's great looking, and, you know, he fantasizes about her, and at the same time, he's struggling in his marriage with his wife, and it's easy to identify with that. It's easy to identify with that. And when I was having, you know, issues about that, when I was in my early 30s, 33, 34, 35, whatever it was, and I'd had you know, all the success that I'd achieved by that point, I was having the same things. It's like, what am I doing here? Is this really what I want to do with my life? Do I really want to be practicing as an attorney? Because everything I'd done up until then was calculated with the pursuit of this goal of becoming an attorney, becoming a partner. And I never allowed myself to really investigate any other options. And in fact, with all the reading that I've done, even just within the last couple of years, and this podcast that I've started, and the classics that I've read, and the strong attention that I've given to reading, where even to the point where I don't watch TV anymore. There's nothing good on TV anymore that is better than reading a book. I mean, I'll still watch a couple of shows, and I'll TiVo them, and it'll be, well, do you want to catch up on How I Met Your Mother, or do you want to read? Well, you know what? I really kind of rather read at this point. And so I look back and I think, maybe I could have done it differently. You know, maybe I could have opted not to go to law school. Maybe I should have focused my efforts on reading and writing and English and the educational pursuit of literature. And maybe I would have enjoyed things better. But by the time you're 35 and you've achieved all your goals, or what you thought were your goals because you had been so narrow focused on those goals, you start to wonder if maybe you could have done things differently. And in Domestic Violets, that's what Tom Violet says. He's 35 years old. He's gotten to where he is, and now he wonders if he even wanted to be here in the first place. And what he really wanted to do was be a writer. And he actually wrote a book, and that was one of the sub-stories of the novel, is that he'd written a book, but he hadn't shown it to anybody. And he was afraid to, and he hadn't shown it to his wife, but he did show it to the girl who he had the crush on, and obviously there's some drama involving the girl and drama involving Tom's relationship with his wife, and she's got her own drama. But you start to look at yourself and say, what if I had it to do over again? Would I have done it the same way? Knowing what I know now, and those are always, you know, the best words to never have to speak, 20/20 hindsight and all that. Knowing what I know now, would I do it all over again? You know, I can tell you, I probably wouldn't. Now, one of the best things that ever happened to me was a result of my going to law school. Would never have happened to me if I never gone to law school, which is meeting my wife, because she and I met in law school. If I didn't go to law school, I don't meet her. We don't get married. We don't have the beautiful children that we have now. But taking that aside, is this what I really was meant to do? Was I meant to practice law? And Tom Violet, is this what he was meant to do? No. He decides that wasn't what he was meant to do. And as the economy starts to crumble around him, because it takes place right around that crash of 2008, 2009, he has that opportunity. And he goes into his boss and he basically says, screw you, I'm out of here. But he does it in a much more literary way. But you start rooting for the guy. You're like, hey, you know what? Good for you. Good for you. You did what all of us out there can't do. You went into your boss and you turned down the promotion and you said, you know what? I appreciate that you want from this promotion. I appreciate you want to give me a whole lot more money. I appreciate you want to give me a whole lot more responsibility. But you know what? This isn't what I was meant to do. I'm not interested. So is it a book for our generation? Yeah. Yeah, it probably is. It probably is. Now, part of the book, I think, was a little bit too fairy tale-ish for me. I haven't read this book, although I have it on my bookshelf, and I will at some point read it. It's called The Corrections by Jonathan Franz, and you may have heard about it. It was a huge bestseller, a huge event book 4 or 5 years ago. And I get the feeling from everything I know about that book without having read it, that this book is very similar to that, because it really involves all the family dynamics of the struggle of the relationships between them and then their relationships with their significant others. Because you've got Tom and his relationship with his wife. You've got Tom's father, Curtis, and Curtis's relationship with his wife. You've got Tom's mother and her relationship with her husband. And you've got the crush, and you've got the crush's relationship with her boyfriend. So there's all these relationship issues that are transpiring throughout the novel. That's the domestic violence, the domestic being the interfamily relationships, and the romantic relationships, and violence obviously being the last name. And I perceive that The Corrections has that same type of a feel to it, although my understanding of The Corrections is it has to be a whole lot darker. It has to be a whole lot seedier or depressing. And Domestic Violence is not like that. Yeah, it deals with some difficult topics. It deals with some hard issues. There's a particular passage where it really was intense, where Tom's wife is discussing, is reliving with him, or is portraying for him, her romantic getaway to Boston and what transpired with the person that she was interested in, or who had the romantic interest in her. And that was real, that was deep, and it was depressing, and it was sad, and it was tense. But other than that, Tom does a good job, but maybe also a little bit of a disservice, by being too comedic, by being too light about some of these issues, by not taking the road that would make it more real. Everything works out in the end. It has a happy ending. Everybody who needs to get back together gets back together. Everybody who needs to be apart needs to be apart. And when you're reading the book, you as a reader know which relationships need to stay together and which relationships really should end. And it works out that way. You know, Tom goes into his boss and says, I'm not interested in the promotion. Then he, you know, goes out of, you know, he quits his job or gets fired in a huge blaze of glory. And when he thinks, this is the first time in my life I'm unemployed, I have nothing else to do, a new opportunity lands in his lap. Then his book gets read and it gets loved, and there's an opportunity there. And then his mother gets him a job teaching, and it seems like everything works out well for him. And I think from some standpoint, you'd like to say, yeah, that's the way it should be. He did what he thought was right. He broke out of his monotony. He solved his problems. He resolved the issue he had with the crush in a way that you as a reader are satisfied with. He resolved his issues with his wife. He resolved his issues with his father. He resolved his issues with his mother. So, you know what? Maybe things should work out for him. Maybe they should. And that's the way we would like it to be. If we have the forethought to follow our dreams, to remedy the relationships that need to be repaired, and get out of the doldrums of the life that we're in pursuit of something that we truly are passionate about, we want to believe that it's going to work out for us. We want to believe that. But that's not real life. And I get that. And I think that Matthew Norman, the author of the book, gets that. But I go back to something that I mentioned in an earlier podcast. As the author of the book, you can create the world however you want it to be. And you can create the world in the image that you would like to see the world as. So a lead child, I think I used this example before, a lead child creating the character Jack Reacher. Jack Reacher, who is a guy's guy, and he's not afraid of anybody, and he can beat up anybody, and he can solve any crime, and, you know, gunshots don't faze him, and all that kind of stuff. The author has the ability to create the character that he would love to be himself, and he can create the world that he would love to live in. I still maintain that Aldous Huxley created the world in Brave New World because he wanted to live in a world like that. That type of a world was a far better alternative to the world in which he was living. And so in that respect, Matthew Norman could create the world he wanted to exist. He could create for his character, for Tom, the result that he wanted to live. And I think we'd all like to do that. Because if we can't force that type of change for our own life, then we might as well live out that fantasy in somebody else's life. And why not the character that we create? if you wanted to sit down and write about, you know, the guy who is afraid of nothing, who will skydive and skateboard and bungee jump and you know, all types of extreme sports stuff, and you yourself don't have the courage to do those things, like I don't, well, why not? Write it out. It's fun to live through somebody else. And I think that Matthew Norman does that. I think he says, you know what? Life sucks, or life has the possibility of being real difficult. It can be real challenging. Very few people have the ability to get out of a situation which they know is not working for them, that they're not happy in, a relationship or a job or whatever type of situation it is. So few people have the power to make the change that they need to get a better life. So why not write the happy ending? Why not take the excitement or the happiness that you can't experience in real life and write it? And write it. Live it out through your characters. And, you know, maybe that's something to ask Matthew Norman. Maybe I'll ask my friend Colin if he can hook me up with this guy, and I'll ask him the question. Why did you make this a happy ending? Why? Life's not like that. Did you make it a happy ending as a way to encourage people to get out of their own way, to make that step and say, hey, you know what? This isn't what I wanted to do with my life. I do have dreams. I have aspirations to do something else. And damn it, I'm going to follow those dreams, even though I'm 35 years old. And maybe that's it. Maybe that's supposed to be the encouragement. Maybe it's supposed to be that inspiration to go do it. Happy endings do happen. They can occur. Why not make it for yourself? It would be an interesting thing to ask the author. I really would be interested in that. But is it a book that for our generation? Yeah, absolutely. Because we all face those types of situations. I don't know very many people who are doing now what they dreamed about when they were 3 years old. Now, my wife does. My wife, from the time she was 3 years old, as early as she can remember, she's always wanted to be an attorney. And good for her. She gets to do what she always dreamed about doing. I hope to God that the life that she has, well, no, not the life, that the career that she has, that the practice of law that she is engaged in now is what she envisioned the practice of law to be when she was 3 years old. Because I guarantee you, you don't have that. When we're kids and we look at the future and we look at careers, a lot of us look at careers that are based upon something having to do with entertainment. We want to be lawyers. We want to be doctors. We want to be firemen. We want to be police officers. We look at these people as heroes, or we look at them as people to look up to because of the way that they think or their expertise or their education. But real life isn't like those things. And I know that what Amy's doing right now, while what she wanted to do since she was a kid, you know, being able to say she's an attorney, is something she'd always dreamed about. But if you were to ask 3-year-old Amy what the practice of law, what she envisioned the practice of law would be and why she wanted to be an attorney, I don't know that it would be reflective of what she's doing now. And I think that's true with a lot of people, and that's true with a lot of careers. So is this a book that should be assigned reading? Well, you know, assigned reading, it's kind of a amorphous idea at this point, because there's so many books out there that people think should be assigned, and I still can't decipher what the redeeming qualities are. But is it something that I would encourage people of my generation to read? Absolutely. Absolutely. Is it something that a 20-something should read? I'm not sure. A 20-something may not get it. 20-something is still bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and pie-in-the-sky type of thing. They don't see the future as anything other than blue skies and, you know, and candy canes or whatever it is, I don't know, something sweet and happy. They don't look at the future as anything other than that. And, you know, they're doe-eyed about it, and that's fine, good for them. But you get to a point where you take stock of where you are and you wonder, is this really what I envisioned? Is this really what I want to do with my life? And in some respect, that's kind of why I'm doing this podcast. Because after 36 years, 37 years on this earth, and every day of my educational life in pursuit, you know, being pushed in pursuit of the ultimate goal of having a career and ultimately becoming an attorney, becoming a partner in a law firm and now starting my own law firm, I got to the point that maybe it wasn't what I was really born to do, being an attorney. I'm not sure yet. People say, you know, what did you want to be when you grew up? And the answer is, I don't know. I'll tell you when I get there. And as I've done all this reading and gotten much more in tune with literature and become so much more enamored with literature, I've often wondered, well, what if there was a job for me in literature? What if there's a job for me in publishing or books or education as a English professor or something like that? And I'm not saying that I'm too old and too far past being able to make any type of significant change in my life. I'm not saying that. But I don't even know what change that would be. And whether I make that type of change or not, I'm not going to tell you. I don't know the answer to it. But if it comes to me, if the aha moment comes and it's, this is what you were born to do, and I make that change, well, then I make that change, and I would be looking forward to that. Until that time, I keep practicing law. But also until that time, I maintain this love with books, and I'll keep doing this podcast because this is my way to vent. This is my outlet. I can't stand in front of a group of kids or students and teach them books. I can just talk into this microphone, and that's my outlet. This is the way that I balance the stress of life, the stress of my job, the you know, maybe there's some level, the disappointment of what my career became, or that my career isn't what I expected it to be, or it's not everything that I'd wanted it to be. So I balance that against, you know, enjoyment in the reading, in discussing books. And sometimes you start to feel really good about it, and you start to feel really bright. And every once in a while, I'll read something, and I'll start to think, hey, you're pretty smart. You picked that up. And actually, in Domestic Violence, there was someone just like that. As I'm reading the book, the main character, Tom, his father's name is Curtis. Curtis happens to be a much celebrated author, he's a celebrity. Everywhere he goes, people know him. And I'm trying to think of who that author might be, because the types of books that Curtis wrote seem to be more along the lines of a John Updike, maybe. And not a contemporary novelist. He's not a contemporary novelist. He's a book award winner. I was gonna say he's a Pulitzer Prize winner, but as the book begins, he's not a Pulitzer Prize winner. He actually wins a Pulitzer towards the end of the book. But he's got a cachet of being an author who is in his 70s, towards the end of his career, but it had such a fantastic career that he really can't go anywhere without being recognized. And as I'm reading the beginning of the book, and then I learn about the character of Curtis, and I find out that there's a character that Curtis has a, I'm not going to say an arch nemesis because it's not really fair. He has another author, a contemporary of his, and this contemporary of his has won just as many awards as he has, but he's also won the Pulitzer, and he's also up for the Pulitzer the same year as Curtis's. And this character's name is Nicholas Zuckerman. And so the character named Nicholas Zuckerman, well, Zuckerman is kind of an interesting name because you don't hear it a lot. It's not I don't interact with any Zuckermans. I haven't come into contact with any Zuckermans. You don't hear about any Zuckermans, but there is a Zuckerman that I am familiar with, and his name is Nathan Zuckerman. And Nathan Zuckerman is a character in a book, in a series of books, by Philip Roth. Philip Roth is an author who is, at this point, probably in his mid-70s, Pulitzer Prize winner, book award winner, well-celebrated author. And he, to me, seems to be a parallel for Curtis Violet, for Tom's father. And thinking that about Philip Roth, and then going back and rethinking the first few chapters of the book. The first few chapters of the book, in this book as well, is told in first-person narrative. The first few chapters of the book are about Tom and his difficulties getting an erection to have sex with his wife. And the tone of that book, the tone of those chapters, and the blanket honesty about this type of a subject, which is really seems like it should be taboo. It really feels like something that shouldn't be discussed, something that, that Tom, though, is bearing his soul to the reader about. It felt an awful lot like Portnoy's complaint by none other than Philip Roth. And I read Portnoy's complaint quite a while ago, and I don't remember a whole lot about it, but what I do remember about it is as I was reading it, there were a lot of ahas to that book. A lot of things where it was like, well, yeah, that's true, or yeah, I understand that completely, or yeah, I get that. And it, Portnoy's complaint talks about all kinds of things from sex to relationships between sons and mothers and interpersonal relationships between men and women. And it's all told from the main character as he is discussing, interesting in light of the name of this podcast, it's a therapy session. So all of these signs point to domestic violence being influenced by Philip Roth, by Portnoy's complaint. You got the Zuckerman, you've got Philip Roth and Curtis Violet, seemingly contemporaries, if not similar types of characters. You've got the blanket honesty of the sexual difficulties that that Tom's having, and it starts to feel like a Philip Roth type novel. And this is one of those things where I go back and I think about The Cask of Amontillado, and I've talked about it before, and I talked about what a horrible experience that was, how the biggest irony, as portrayed by the teacher at the time, the biggest irony about the book was that the character's name was Fortunato, and he wasn't very fortunate. And while I didn't disagree that was ironic. I disagreed with the teacher for saying that that was the most ironic part of the story, that there was no other alternative to that interpretation of it being the most ironic part of the story. But what that reading experience did was it brought me much more in tune with characters' names, because characters' names can let you in on things. And when I see in the book that Curtis's arch nemesis contemporary is Nicholas Zuckerman, and Zuckerman, I focus on the word Zuckerman, I think of Philip Roth, and I think of Philip Roth, and I think of Portnoy's complaint, and I think about the first, I think about the honesty and the sexuality and the unleashing of the unleashing of anything that was taboo, similar to the way that Tom does at the beginning of Domestic Violence. It all starts to wrap itself up to in each other. And so I start to feel like I'm part of the in-joke. Like Matthew Norman threw this little cookie in to see who's paying attention, to see who is getting it. A little in-joke. Anybody get the idea? Hey, I just threw this name Zuckerman in. Anybody out there get that Zuckerman was written by Philip Roth, and Philip Roth, the Portnoy's complaint, Anybody getting that? And I'm, kind of getting a little bit pride in myself, thinking, yeah, I got it. And what's interesting is at the end of the book, after the book is over, and the Kindle version, there's a couple of essays. One of them is an interview with the author, and one of them is books, recommendations. If you like this book, you want to see what some of the author's influences were. And one of them was, I think, The Corrections by Jonathan Franzen. Interesting. But on top of that, one of the recommendations, a Philip Roth book. And I am smiling when I read this. I get to the end, I go, yeah, I knew it. Yeah. Anybody else out there? I'm looking around, looking into space, going, hey, anybody else who read this book, you pick up on that? I picked up on it. I got it. Yeah. And it's those types of things where I start to feel really good about myself for whatever reason. I feel like, hey, I got the in-joke. Because those are the types of things that you would hear in an English class. That's the kind of a thing that an English teacher would pick up on and would ask the class, anybody understand this? What does this all mean? Because you see it all the time. Authors are making in-jokes about other authors. Characters are making in-jokes about other characters. There's references to all kinds of previous books or stories, wherever it is. And those are the kinds of things that get picked up on by English teachers. And not that I'm an English teacher, I'm certainly not, but in another life, could I have been? Yeah, maybe. Because I figured out that this was influenced by a Philip Roth book. And so I, you know, I felt excited about that. What can I tell you? Okay, you know what? Simple things. Simple things. So I think that's enough, don't you? We've been going for a long time. Certainly talked a lot about the books I've read. Now, I got to tell you, I'm not going to jinx it. I'm not going to jinx it, but I think I found the book. I think I found the book. It came out Tuesday, just this past Tuesday, only 3 days ago. I'm not going to tell you who wrote it. I'm not going to tell you what it's about. I'm not going to tell you what it's called. But what I'm going to tell you is, I think this is the one that's got everything I'm looking for. And it's by an author I've never read before. And I'm about 100 pages in, and so far, it's got it. It's a marathon, not a sprint. So the author's got to keep it up. It's got to keep the intensity. I think it's there. So we'll talk about that next time. And if it's not this book, I'm really confident in a week and a half, another book's going to be arriving on my door. This one I'm really excited about because it's a sequel to one of the top five books in my list of last year. And one of the books I've mentioned on this podcast before, and one of the books that I know will have everything I'm looking forward to. So we'll talk about that next time. Thanks again for letting me lie on your couch. This is Rob Cohen. This is Book Therapy.